You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Lizzie. You remember those priorities we talked about at the beginning of the show? Well, this past week, President Donald Trump proposed a military spending increase of $54 billion and a plan to cut that same amount of money from the EPA and other government entities. Now, this is actually a relatively predictable set of priorities coming from a Republican administration. Budgeting is, after all, generally a partisan affair. To get some sense of how budgeting by politics has worked throughout the years, we spoke to Edward Kleinbard, professor of law and business at USC's Gould School of Law. He's also the author of We Are Better Than This: How Government Should Spend Our Money. We started by talking about how politics influence the federal budget.
The budget is a document that has to be passed every year by the Congress, signed by the president. And so in almost every year, it requires bipartisan working towards a common goal, because in most years in this country, the presidency and the two chambers of Congress are not held by the same party. Mm-hmm. And the important point to remember is that the budget is not the creation of the president. The budget is the creation of Congress. Congress controls spending in this country.
So how consistent would you say is the kind of partisan philosophy, it coming either from Congress or from the president? Does the process of working out that budget, it seems like it sometimes can, you know, you tend to think Republicans are stingier with the purse strings and Democrats are not so much. But that isn't always the case, right?
No, in fact, it's rarely the case. Republicans, when they are in opposition, are in favor of small government. And as we saw during the George W. Bush administration, when Republicans controlled both the presidency and both chambers of Congress, we had a relatively free spending period with respect to the budget. Ronald Reagan was an enormous spender, relative in particular to the tax revenues that came in. In fact, this country has had two big periods where the budget was way out of whack since World War II, where we were spending a great deal more than we were taking in. One of those, of course, was in the 2008-11 economic crisis, where we teetered on the edge of another Great Depression and tax revenues collapsed. But the other actually goes all the way back to the Reagan era, when the president proposed large tax cuts, and the result was enormous deficits in peacetime, attributable to the failure to keep tax revenues up with spending levels.
Well, then let's talk about what's happening now, at least in terms of the suggestions from the administration. Can you put President Trump's suggestions about military spending, which I think would be coupled with some tax cuts, or at least tax cuts certainly on businesses. Can you put some of that into context?
Sure. So military spending in this country for national defense has actually been relatively constant over time in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars. It went up significantly in the 1980s. Under President Reagan, it came down again and hit a recent low at the end of the Clinton administration. It went up again after 2001, of course. And today it stands at about $600 billion a year, give or take, which is about 15% of the total budget that the government's spending. So to add $54 billion on top of the $600 billion that we are currently spending on national defense is a very substantial, it's a 9 or 10% increase at a time when it is not absolutely clear, to me at least, what that money is needed for. The other side, we spend about the same amount of money on all non-defense discretionary spending. That is the stuff that Congress argues about every year, the stuff that is reflected in the president's budget and appropriated by Congress. All of that together accounts for another 15% of the budget. 70% of the budget is basically on autopilot. So only 30% of the budget is essentially up for negotiation every year.
Interesting.
And that, as I said, is about half and half. So to move $54 billion in effect from the non-defense to defense spending is a big cut in non-defense programs. And they are right now at a very low level relative to our national income, our GDP. And a cut of that magnitude is actually going to be quite painful, and it's going to affect the quality of life Americans experience.
I guess that leads nicely into the question of an obstructionist Congress. How might that affect this process, and how much can we expect this president and Congress to actually get done in terms of such sweeping change?
So the president proposes a budget. The president can't spend money unless Congress authorizes it. So in the end, the purse strings of the government are entirely in the hand of Congress. At the moment, the Congress is the same political party as the president. The obstructionism will come from within the Republican Party, but political allegiances are awfully strong. So it seems to me improbable that we're going to find a lot of obstructionism in the current 115th Congress. To the contrary, some of the goals of the president and of congressional leadership, of Speaker Ryan, for example, overlap quite considerably. So the idea that we're going to put more money into military, always hard to resist because there are military, either military installations or defense contractors in every district in the country. And the idea that we're going to kick non-defense discretionary spending in the groin, well, you know, that has some political resonance among the president's base.
Let's talk about the potential sort of shift back and forth. There's, I assume, a certain amount of policy and budget reversal. There's plenty going on right now. There is reversal to be expected, assuming that there could be a shift of power from Republicans to Democrats. Then there could be another reversal. At what point do we start to see the effects of that?
Well, the large government programs and the large government agencies are like super tankers. You know, they do take a long time to turn around, but once they've turned around in one direction, it takes an awful long time to get them back to where they were. And in general, it's a lot easier to destroy than it is to build. You can starve an agency and destroy its collective expertise in a lot shorter period of time than you can build that up.
That's Edward Kleinbard, professor of law and business at USC Gould School of Law. And thanks so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.